I was going to say good morning, but I think it's noon, whatever it is. My name is Bob Zetz, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm really, really happy to be here. I'm thankful that we got invited to come here, and I've had a great time. I've enjoyed all the speakers so far, and I hope you have too. And, you know, we got off to a great start with Joe, and then my old friend Bob Fisher talked yesterday morning, and I love hearing him talk. In fact, after the meeting, after he talked, I thanked him, and he reminded me that I'd forgot all about it. He reminded me that I gave him his first speaking gig he was about less than a year sober, and I took him to Ojai with me one time, and he was a 10-minute speaker, and he hasn't shut up since then, I guess. and Mac and Kay, who are old dear friends of ours that we love, and everybody, and I, you know, when you do something like this, you think about, you know, how you're going to talk and all that. And as I was sitting there, I'm looking out in this audience, and all these different thoughts go through my mind because of some of the people that are here. Four of the most important people in my life are here. My sponsor, my wife's sponsor, who happens to be my sponsor's wife, my wife and my grandson, and a lot of old friends. And you know, it really, really makes me feel humble. Speaking of my wife, we were in Hawaii a couple months ago, and we were out by the pool, and Clancy and my sponsor were sitting next to each other, and I said, I'm going to tell you guys something that probably won't impress you, but it impresses the hell out of me, because you've both been married to the same woman for over 50 years, but we're celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary this weekend, and that may not be like something to you, but this is my fifth marriage. And Clancy was impressed. Keith knew it, so he wasn't really impressed. And we have a great life now. We really do, because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the only way I can screw up my life is to think about it. You know, if I think about it, it gets screwed up. So I've got to stay active in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been very lucky because. When I moved out to Los Angeles in the late 1980, and I got the sponsor that I have now in early 1981, and he taught me something that I really needed, and that was to be an enthusiastic, active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he didn't teach me that by telling me about it; he taught me that by doing it. And I followed him around, and I'm still following him around. And he's one of the most active people that I've ever known in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he's kept me that way. So as a result of that, I don't have to think about my life too much. And I'm very grateful for that. And another word I just thought, grateful. I was reading some stuff recently that Bill Wilson wrote about gratitude. And a line jumped off the page at me. And what it said was that gratitude without action is just a pleasant emotion. And I really thought about that. You know, I've been thinking about it a lot lately. I've been taking a little bit of inventory of my activities in Alcoholics Anonymous and my life and what I'm doing. And am I active enough to be grateful? Am I passing this thing on? And am I taking the responsibility for the years of sobriety I have and being an example to other people? And I fall down on that a lot, I'm sure. But it really, really put something back in my heart and in my mind that I really want to strive for, you know. I don't want to have that pleasant emotion. I want to be in action in Alcoholics Anonymous. So that's what I try to do, and as a result of that, things are pretty good for me most of the time. I don't know when I started drinking. I really don't. I was listening to Glenn this morning, and I've heard a lot of speakers talk about they know when they started drinking, and they know that when they took a drink, it took away this feeling that they had, whatever that was. And I don't relate to any of that stuff. As a matter of fact, I don't relate to anything in the third chapter when it talks about all the stuff that we did, quit drinking and switched from scotch to brandy. The only thing I relate to that is I took a lot of trips. But other than that, I don't relate to any of that stuff because I'm an alcoholic. The only thing I relate to is that I was out there trying to have fun, as much fun as I could, and everything that I did seemed like the right thing to do at the time. It seemed like a really good idea at the time to do. And I don't remember ever taking a drink to squash a feeling. I just don't remember that. But I'll tell you about a little bit about me, what it was like and what happened, what I'm trying to do now. I grew up in a small town in Northern California, a small inn called Sacramento. And I come from a family that lived there a long time. My parents are both born there, and I was well connected in the town with all the people. And it was a very small town then. And I had a kind of a weird childhood, and it's really funny, you know. Clancy talks about it, and Glenn's talking about that perception. My perception of my childhood is great. I don't have a bad perception of my childhood. My brother, who's 2.5 years older than me, has a terrible perception of our childhood. Because when World War II started, my father and mother got divorced. My father had to go in the Navy, and my mother she did what alcoholic women do. They're both alcoholics. She did what alcoholic women do. She was chasing soldiers and running all over the country. And we ended up in a children's home. And then we ran away from that and we did it together. Then we ended up in a foster home. We ran away from that. We ended up in another foster home. We ran away from that. We did that I don't know how many times. And my recollection of that is because we'd hop a freight train and go somewhere and camp out by the river or something. My recollection of it was a big camping trip. My brother has real bad feelings about those times, you know. Anyway, we finally ended up in one place and spent the entire 2 or 3 years that the war was on. And then when the war was over, my parents went back together. They got married again. And they were going to do all the right things that they should do for their kids. You know, they put us in Catholic school. I went to Sacred Heart. Then I went to Christian Brothers. And, you know, I became an altar boy. And I did all the stuff you're supposed to do. And they were trying to do the best they could do. And my father went into business, and he started making a lot of money, and things were great, you know. Everything was doing fine. They were drinking a lot. It never bothered me. When I became a teenager, it never bothered me because I had zero supervision, and I loved that. The only thing that I would go sometimes a week and never even see them, but they always left money on the kitchen table for me every morning. And in those days in California, you could get a driver's license when you're 14. So when I was 14, I got a driver's license on a really gorgeous 34 Ford coupe, all hopped up chrome. I mean, you know, everybody looked at it. I had a driver's license, I had a car, and I had money, and he even gave me a gas credit card. And then I got a fake ID. I mean, Jesus, what more do you need? I mean, life is wonderful, you know? And I started having a ball. And people talk about feeling different, you know, and I don't really relate to that either. I felt different, but I'll tell you how I felt different. I was always the guy that everybody wanted to hang around because I had the car and I had the money, you know. So I had a lot of friends. I never felt apart from in my whole teenage years. I had a ball in my teenage years. You know, I'd go to Reno, I'd go to San Francisco, I'd do all the stuff, and I had this fake ID, and I started drinking in bars. I don't know why I started drinking, I really don't. It just seemed like the thing to do. In the late 40s, everybody drank, you know. There was no television. Everybody had a favorite bar that they went to. Everybody hung out in different bars, and I just started drinking in bars. That's what I did. I mean, I don't remember when I started. I don't remember why I started. I don't remember anything. I know now that the only thing that really saved me to get deep in alcoholism early was I was really obsessed with cars. I spent every waking minute that I had off work or whatever, except on the weekends, fooling with cars. And I was racing. I was going to Bonneville and going down here to El Mirage and to the drags and all that stuff. And I had a great time doing all that. So that saved me from really getting into alcoholism. And then I met this girl that kind of caught my fancy, and very young I got married. I was 17 when I got married first time, but I was working for my father, and you know, things were great. I thought, you know, hey, my father offered to send me to college, offered to let me pay for me to go to Notre Dame. That's what he wanted me to do. You know, I didn't have the grades for it, but he would have paid for me to go anywhere, and I didn't want to go to college. You know, I wanted to be a businessman. I wanted to be somebody. You know, I wanted to make a lot of money, and I didn't, you know, you couldn't do that in college. And I was in a hurry. I didn't want to wait to go to school, you know. I've always been in a hurry. So I went to work for him, and I figured, you know, one of these days I'll take over the business, and everything will be wonderful. And And that was my first, that was my plan. So I got married and we started having kids, and it was very, it was bad. We beat the hell out of each other on a regular basis, you know. And I'd drag my, she'd throw me out and I'd drag my clothes out and I'd bring them back in. I wore my clothes out, bringing them back in. I mean, it's just that way for years. And then something happened that made me make my first I'll never do that statement. I don't know if any of you guys have ever done that. Have you ever said, I'll never do that, based on something that somebody else did? And what happened is my father went bankrupt. And he went bankrupt as a direct result of his drinking, and I knew it, and my brother and I knew it. And we both talked about it. I can remember like it was yesterday we talked about it. Man, I will never let alcohol cause me to do what it caused him to do. And, you know, here I am. My brother got here 12 years before me, so... So I'll never do it. Didn't work for me anyway. If you're an active alcoholic like I am, there's one thing that doesn't happen to me. I don't learn from my mistakes. I never learn from my mistakes. I keep doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. You know. So, what's an alcoholic do when he hasn't got a job? He goes in business. You know. So I went in business. My brother and I started building spec houses. And wouldn't you know, I got very successful. Right out of the box, I got successful. Man, I started making all kinds of money, you know. And what's an alcoholic do when he starts making all kinds of money? You know, spend it. And this lasted probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. And we were doing really well. And then all of a sudden, woke up one day and there was nothing. It was gone. And I was broke, and how the hell did this happen? My sponsor talks about climbing the ladder of success 75% and then falling back, you know. I climb the ladder of success, and I get there, and then I crash, you know. And I crashed in my business, and my wife divorced me, which I wasn't too upset about anyway. That was going real bad. And I moved somewhere. I don't know where I went. I left town, and I got into another deal, and I got into another deal, and deal after deal after deal, and I was a terrible husband. I was a terrible husband. Then I met another lady who was totally the opposite. She's the one that I snap my finger and say jump. She'd say hi. And she just totally did what anything I wanted to do. And I married her, and. Was married for about, almost a year, I guess, and I found out in that marriage that I have another disease, and it's called this ain't it-ism. Because after a while, I thought, man, this ain't it. You know, this is too boring for me. So I divorced her, and I married the first one again. And that didn't seem like too good of an idea very shortly after that. So, but during that second marriage, I'll tell you, one of my ways that I take care of problems, I always like to talk about this because it gives you an idea how I solve problems. She woke up one morning, she had a hangover, and she said, I can't go to work today. Would you go call work for me and tell them I got the flu? And I was in between deals, so we didn't have a phone. The phone had been disconnected. And so I drove to the phone booth to call, and I'm thinking, you know, I don't have to put up with this crap. Why should I have to do that, you know? Instead of the phone booth, and I was in Sacramento, I went to Las Vegas, and I lived there for a year. And, you know, I never told her, I just, you know. And of course, I never sent any money to support the kids. I never did anything. And then after that, I got into another deal, and I started making tons of money. And I was living in Seattle, making tons of money. I mean, I made more money than I ever thought even existed. And I was just really, you know, living the high life. I mean, it's going to Vegas, going to Reno, going to New York, going to everywhere you want to think of. And I buy my, during those times when I had that money, I'd spoil my kids. You know, I'd fly them here, I'd fly them there, I'd do all these things. When my son was 5 years old, I bought him a car for Christmas. Give you an idea of how goofy I was, you know. But then there'd be times that years would go by, they didn't even know where I was at. I'd sent nothing, you know, I was a total flake. And I remember when I got my Social Security statement that they send you, you know, I don't know if anybody's ever done this, how much money you made a year, there's big blanks in mine, you know. And like I didn't exist, I fell off the face of the earth. And that's pretty much what I did. And finally I got all the deals I was in and were kind of falling out. Oh, by the way, yeah, I left, when I got back from Las Vegas, I married the second one again. So I married the second one again. So I had four marriages to two different women. Forgot about that. Anyway, the second one again's mother had a rest home in Sparks, Nevada, which is right next door to Reno. And I'd come back from a deal back east and had gone bust, and I was totally busted. I had no money. I didn't know what the hell to do. My mother finally said, "I'm not giving you any more money," and she meant it, and I couldn't con her on any more money. I don't know what happened, but she just wouldn't give me any more money. So I called my mother-in-law, and I said, "You know, Reno's always been a kind of town I think would work for me. Can I come and stay with you for a while until I get on my feet?" And she said, "Okay," so I moved to Reno. And one of my friends that I grew up with in Sacramento is an Armenian guy, and his family owned a really, really successful Armenian restaurant in Sacramento. In fact, I built it for him, because I've always been in the building business beside that, too. And I said, "Ronnie, why don't we open a restaurant in Reno?" He said, "You know, I've always wanted to. I'll tell you what, you find the location, build the restaurant, and when you get it all done, I'll go in partners with you, and I'll show you how to run a restaurant." I said, "Okay, fine." I was driving a cab at the time. I had zero money. So I started hustling everybody I knew, every relative I knew, and a couple of my aunts had just become widows, and they had a lot of money, and I nailed them, you know. Anyway, I built this gorgeous restaurant, this really nice restaurant, and I thought this time it's going to be different. This time I'm going to really be a up the right citizen. I'm going to pay my bills. I'm going to do what I'm supposed to do. I'm going to go to work every day, you know. I really want this thing to work because, you know, I've been through I don't know how many deals like this, and it never worked. It worked for a while, but I said, this time it's going to be different. I really meant that. And just before the restaurant was opening, we had all the booze delivered, and I was stocking the bar. It was about a week before it was supposed to be open. So, of course, I got to sample it as I'm putting in the back bar. And I drove home, and I got nailed for drunk driving in Sparks. And I thought, oh, man. And you know, that was the first thought. Then the second thought was, no big deal. I've driven 10,000 times drunk. I'm due. You know, pay a little fine. That'll be the end of it. And I'd been stopped for drunk driving in Sacramento many times. But my father knew all the judges and all the cops. And my brother got busted for drunk driving one time, and I went to court with him. Not in court. We went in the judge's chambers. And he said, "I got to do something, so I'll fine you $50. So I thought that's what they did, you know, but I forgot I wasn't in Sacramento. In fact, to give you an idea of how things I got away with, one time in Sacramento I was driving down Broadway about 3 a.m. it was Armed Forces Day, and they had a big parade. And they'd left some of the stuff in the parade on the side of the street, and I hit a parked tank. And I was going to keep going. I had this beautiful 41 Ford Coupe. Gorgeous 41 Ford coupe, and I wiped out the whole side of it, and it wouldn't drive. So I had to pull over, and a cop pulled up right behind me. And he said, "Let me see your license." I got out drunk. I couldn't even hardly stand up. And he says, "You related to Matt Zetz?" And I said, "Yeah, he's my father." And he said, "Okay." And he took a piece of paper, and he said, "Okay, go put a note on the tank and tell him who you are." "Let me put a note on the tank, and I'll take you home." So that happened to me several times, not hitting tanks, but being stopped, you know. Anyway, so I figured, no big deal, you know, I'll pay the fine and all that. But anyway, then the restaurant opens, and we're doing great, you know, got the big grand opening, things are going great. And about 2 weeks after the restaurant opens, I'm driving home one night to Sparks, and I got an attorney, and the attorney that I got owned a casino in Sparks, and on the ground floor was a casino and a bar in the back with live music and live girls and all the things I like, you know. And I went in this, I'm drunker than hell, and I stop in the front of the thing, and I go in this bar to see if anything's happening. It's about 3 a.m. And I come out, and there's nothing going on, so I come out, and there's a cop standing by my car. And I guess I'd been out on Highway 40 going the wrong way on a freeway. Because he said, you know, you were just out, we got your license, you were just out on Highway or Interstate 80 going the wrong way on the freeway. And I said, no, not me, man. I've been here for hours. And, you know, not me, I've been here for hours. Anyway, so he couldn't really arrest me for it. So keen alcoholic thinking. He's standing there. I get in the car and drive off. And I go around the corner, and of course he nails me. Now I got two drunk drivings, you know, in 25 days, and I know I'm going to be in trouble. And but something good came out of that, because not too long after that, I was in that bar, and this really cute cocktail waitress. And in those days, they wore hot pants. Remember the hot pants? And she had a great body, and she was gorgeous, man. She just, wow. And so I started gazing at her, and I went in one night. I was drunk the first time I went. The next time I went in, I was not real drunk, and I said, I started talking to her, and I said, don't I know you from somewhere? And I really meant it, and she looked kind of familiar. Come to find out, we'd known each other in Sacramento and in Seattle and all this. And then, anyway, that's my 30-year wife. She was working in this cocktail lounge, and of course I was still married. And so, but I didn't have a, they took my driver's license, so I would have her drive me around to the bars, you know, and actually take me home and drop me off. And so we fell into immediate lust, you know. And one thing led to another. She came to work for me. I got rid of my wife, and one thing led to another, and we got married, you know. And we started on this, you know, yellow brick road. I mean, I guess that's what you call it. And we were having a fantastic time in Reno, partying. We knew everybody. Knew all the guys, all the casinos owners, they were all local then. We used to comp the maitre d's and all that, so when I'd go to the shows, they'd comp us. I mean, I could get, you know, reservations and free drink. I could drink in any casino free in Reno. I mean, I was something, man. I was a big deal. I was a legend in my own mind. And I was having a lot of fun, and Betty Ann was going right along with it, you know. And one night she screwed me up. She didn't screw me up, but I didn't know at the time it was going to screw me up. But we were going to go out. We'd close the restaurant maybe 12, and we'd go downtown and drink at all the different places. And one night she says, I can't do this anymore. And I said, can't do what? She goes, I can't go drink all night with you and then get up in the morning and go work. And I said, oh, okay. Well, go home. I don't need you to drink with me. I know how to do that alone. And she, my life changed, because now she was obsessed with why am I drinking so much. First time in my life I'd ever had somebody do that, you know. And as a matter of fact, that's one thing I don't understand about Al-Anons. I don't understand why they care about what somebody else is doing. Because, I mean, she used to, then I had to start taking a cab, and she'd call Whittlesey and tell him, you know, where you got, because I had an account with Whittlesey. She goes, I know you got him, where'd you take him, you know. And that she'd finally con him into where it just took me, and she'd show up. You know, come into the bar and start raising hell, or in the casino and start raising hell. And life was getting very, very interesting. And I just didn't know what the hell to do about it, you know. I'd never been in that kind of thing before. And I had no idea that I had a drinking problem. I really didn't. I thought, you know, I was just doing what I've done my whole life. I didn't know that there was anything wrong with it. Now, And the funny thing about it is, if you looked at Betty Ann and I, you'd say, there's a really nice, successful couple. Nice young couple. We were young then, too. Nice, young, successful couple, because we lived in the right house on the right block. We lived right across the street from Harold Smith's wife, you know, of Harold's Club. I mean, yeah, not Harold, the father. And we lived, like I say, Southwest Reno. We had the right car. We dressed right. We knew the right people. But our life was going to hell in a handbasket, and I was going to hell in a handbasket financially too. I was stealing out of that money out of that restaurant faster than it was coming in. Because I had another little problem when I drank and I went down to the casinos. I used to gamble. And some people call it gambling, because when you gamble, sometimes you win. I never won. I never ever walked out of there with some of their money. And I was stealing money out of the restaurant, and I was running credit cards, and I was doing everything I could to keep up. I had 15 balls in the air, man, and I'll tell you, I was getting tired, and I didn't know it. My life was total chaos and total, you know, just constant something. And I'll tell you, you know, when you live in that, it becomes normal. I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know that my life was in chaos until I got out of the chaos. And we went on like this for a few months, and Betty Ann went down to San Diego with some people that we knew in Reno to some kind of a show, and she went and saw, my brother was living there at the time. And she went and saw my brother and his wife, who was in Al-Anon, and they talked to her. And I guess they told her, you know, hey, whether he stops drinking or not, you need to do something about yourself, you know, and what you do will be a great great help to helping him get sober. And she came back, and man, life got real interesting then. That's all she talked about, AA and Al-Anon, you know, and I didn't want to go to AA and Al-Anon, man, you know, I'm having fun, so one Saturday morning on October the 20th, 1974, I got in the house, I came home about 10 in the morning, which wasn't unusual. I'd lost all my money, of course. I still don't understand this, but it's true. I lost the car, but I wasn't supposed to be driving the car, so I don't even know how I got the car, but I lost it. And she said to me, I'm not going to do this anymore. It's over. Either you do something about your drinking, or it's over. I'm going to take you for everything you ever had, everything you ever thought of having. And I thought, you know, Jesus, this would really be an inconvenient time for another divorce, you know. And for some reason I thought, I can't give her everything I have. All I have is a bunch of debt, actually. I had nothing. And so I said, okay, what do you want me to do, you know? She goes, I want you to call AA. And then I thought, you know what? AA can't be that bad. I could probably go stand on my head there a couple weeks, because I knew all I'd have to do it for would be a couple of weeks, because Betty Ann is just like me. She starts all kinds of things, but she never finishes them, because by that time she'd been to the psychiatrist, she'd been to the palm reader, she'd been to the astrologer, she'd been to the doctors, she was taking Valium or something else to try to keep me from drinking, and none of it worked. And every 2 weeks she'd get a new idea. So I figured she'll go to Al-Anon for 2 weeks and she'll get a new idea, you know. So I said, okay, I'll call. And I called and the line was busy. And finally got through to this lady, Mary D., who's become a very close friend of ours. Tom and Patty know her. And who are old friends of ours from Reno Lake College. In fact, Tom's the only guy that saw me drink drunk that I know of. And he knew me when I was drinking. He's the only guy in AA that I know of that knew me when I was drinking. Because none of the other ones made it, I guess. Anyway, I finally got through, and Mary said, well, we're having a meeting tonight. Can you come? And I said, well, I'd like to, but I have to go see Liberace, but I'll catch you some other time. I mean, I was really sincere, you know. And the next night we went to the meeting at the VA hospital in Reno, and people tell us that Betty Ann had on a cocktail dress and a big hat and long gloves. And I don't remember that, you know. And I was dressed in suit, and we go to the VA hospital. And I don't know how many people have ever been to an AA meeting in a VA hospital, but, you know, all these guys come in with a Thorazine shuffle, you know, and they got these little bathrooms under, so smoking. And we both looked at each other and thought, Jesus, what have we done, you know? And actually, that became one of my favorite meetings. But I was not impressed. And the next day, I went to the class meeting in Reno at the Dryers Club called the Puke on the Shoes Group. And Betty Ann went to her first Al-Anon meeting. And I, on the way home from that meeting, I told Betty Ann, I said, Betty Ann, you know, I told you I'd try this, and I made a commitment to my brother, who I was very close to, that I'd do this for 60 days, but I don't know if I can do this, man. This is too kooky for me. And she goes, well, you told your brother you'd do it, so just try it for a while, you know. So the next day I went to a meeting in Sparks, Nevada, and the Miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me. And I think it's the same now as it was then. I know that. And what that is one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. Because I was standing over against the wall because I couldn't talk to anybody, and a guy came up to me. His name's Bill Reeder. He's now dead. And he said, are you okay? And I said, why? And he said, man, you look terrible. I said, I do? He said, you look like you're going to fly apart. I said, I do? I had no idea that I looked that way. You know, I'd been drinking for, I don't know, years and years and years, as much as I could drink. If I was awake, I was drinking. And I just stopped. And I don't know what happens to you when you stop, but I guess it happened to me, you know. And I was not in real good shape. And Bill kind of took me under his wing, and he took me over to his house after the meeting, and we talked, and he played some tapes for me. And the first tape I heard was Clancy. The first AA tape I ever heard was Clancy. And he was in his pendulum days. I don't know if anybody remembers this, remember? And I thought, Jesus, if this crazy bastard could stay sober, anybody can. And I was, you know, it really made an impression on me. And his wife was in Al-Anon. She met Betty Ann, and we started doing the stuff that you do in Alcoholics Anonymous, and getting involved and going to meetings and doing what you do. And we'd have banquet parties at our banquet room in the restaurant, and we'd have parties at the Alano Club, and I'd make meatloaf and all this stuff. And I was doing all the stuff, and I really loved the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I really did. I began to really love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I loved it almost enough to stay sober. And I, you know, that's a very important thing for me to remember, I think, because if you're anything like this alcoholic, loving Alcoholics Anonymous and making meatloaf is not going to keep you sober. And that's all I did. I'd go to meetings and I'd talk to people, or they'd talk to me. I've always had a tough time talking to people. But I never got into the program. I didn't have a sponsor. I never asked Bill to be my sponsor. I never started working the steps. I never did any of that stuff. I just went to meetings. And my head started working on me. And it started doing the stuff it does to alcoholics. So, you know, I was an alcoholic going to meetings without a program. And I don't think there's anything more uncomfortable than that. You know, and eventually my head just, I knew that I had to turn my head off. And the only thing that came to my mind was that, you know, I never had this problem in my head when I was drinking. So if I take a drink, it'll probably turn my head off. So one night I just decided to go drink, and I did. It was on a Tuesday night, and I didn't have a meeting that night, so I didn't miss a meeting. And I went and drank, and you know what? It didn't turn my head off. It didn't do nothing. It didn't do anything. It just made me miserable. The next day, a guy that I sponsored came over, and he had about 3 months of sobriety. Let's see. And Betty Ann made us throw us out of the house. She said, take him somewhere. I'm sick of looking at him. Yeah. And he took me to a bar not too far from our house, about a mile from where we lived, the Continental Lodge. And I knew the bartender there, and I told Les, you know, buy me a drink. And he said, I don't think I'm supposed to do that. And I said, I'm your sponsor. Do what I tell you. You know? So he said, I can't watch this. And he bought me a couple of drinks, and he left. And somebody at this conference mentioned that they, I think it was Mac Brewster, mentioned that he took a drink, his last drink, and he couldn't swallow it. And I took this drink, and I couldn't swallow it. Everything I tried, I just couldn't get this damn VO on the rocks down. It's the first time in my life I couldn't swallow a drink. And I thought, man, I'm screwed. I can't drink, and AA don't work. Now what the hell am I going to do, you know? So I walked home. It was January of 1976, and it was snowing in Reno, and it was cold, and I'm walking home. And at my Tuesday night discussion meeting last week, the subject was moment of clarity. And I hadn't really brought that up for a long time. And then they said, the guy that was leading the meeting said, tell us about your moment of clarity. And I remember mine like it was yesterday. It was walking home from that bar on January the 21st, 1976. And the moment of clarity I had was that for some reason I became completely aware of the fact that I was an alcoholic. And if I had any chance at all of having any kind of a life, I'm going to have to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm going to have to get a sponsor. I'm going to have to try to work the steps. And I'm going to live miserably ever after. And it was okay. I accept it, you know, because we had a new baby then. Our son had been born the previous October, and I loved my wife. I didn't want to break up that marriage. And I said, fine, I'll go do it, and I'll be a martyr, and I'll live miserably ever after. And so I got a sponsor, you know, and I got the sponsor, John, that I was actually married to Betty Ann's sponsor. And I started doing. I started beginning to work the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and things began to slowly change for me. The one thing that I really, really had a problem with, though, was the God thing. you know, and doing the, I started doing the steps, and then, you know, and I remember when I was new, I'd go to discussion meetings. One of the things that happened to me in discussion meetings, which, and I wish I'd do that more now, I don't want to put down any newcomers, there's a lot of them here, but if somebody that didn't know me knew I was new called on me at a discussion meeting, I remember usually it was Tokay Red would talk and said, you know, tell him your name and you're glad to be here, you ain't got nothing to say. Which I didn't, you know, I had nothing to say. What the hell have I got to say when I'm 2-3 months sober? And so I didn't talk a lot, but when I did, one of the things I did talk a little bit about was God. You know, I talk about, you know, I know they say higher power and all that crap, but they mean God, you know. We got to find God. And, you know, and that's why I thought, you got to find God. I mean, I need to see a burning bush or a cloud talk to me or something, you know, because I got to find God if I'm going to make this program. And that's the attitude I had about this thing called God. And it was very difficult for me. I really, really had a hard time with it. And we had a convention in Reno, and a speaker came to the convention, and he talked about, in fact, he was a Sunday morning speaker, like I am at that thing. And he talked about finding God, and he talked about, you know, it says in the big book that we're not going to find God, we're going to seek God. And my belief is that, he said this, my belief is the closest you'll ever get to God is in the seeking. And I kind of took that in. I said, you know, hey, maybe that'll work for me. Just seek God. Maybe I can begin to have some kind of relationship with God. Then I, not too long after that, I had an opportunity to go on a retreat in Santa Cruz with the late Father Barney Nixon. I don't know how many people here remember Barney Nixon. Fantastic guy. And I was having trouble with finishing my fourth step, and I took it with me. It was about this big, you know. You know, I got to have a perfect fourth step, man. I got to have everything on that fourth step. And I didn't think I did. I was sure that there was something I forgot. So I talked to him about it, and I said, you know, I can't get my fourth step done. He said, why not? And I said, well, I don't think I have everything on it. And he said, I'll give you a little clue on how to finish your fourth step. Here, say this. And I've done this with the people I've sponsored over the years, you know. Dear God, forgive me for the things I've done against you that you know about and I don't. And I thought, Jesus, that's it, man. You know, done. I was done with my fourth step. You know, just, you know, came out of the blue. And I did one fourth step, and I think it was a fantastic fourth step, and I've never had to do another one. For me, I've done a lot of them, taking guys through the fourth step. But I talked to Father Barney about this thing with God, and I told him, I have a hell of a time, you know, I just can't relate to this God thing. And he said, well, what are you doing? And I told him, I'm reading this stuff and doing all that. He said, well, do you pray? And I said, no, I don't know how to pray. He said, well, you know, you probably got to pray. And I said, I don't know how to pray. And he said, I'm going to give you a prayer. And I said, okay, here's how you start out. God, teach me how to pray. Say that every day and see what happens. And I did that, and it began to work, you know. Simple little stuff that we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, me, I got to have the burning bush and the guy talking out of the cloud. And as a result of that, you know, my life started to change. But things, you know, bad things happen to good people. And I think Betty and I are good people. I mean, since we've been in the program. A year after our son was born, we had twin girls, very unexpectedly. And we were really excited about it, and everything was great. And Betty Ann was home, stayed home, was taking care of the babies. And one morning she went in to feed the babies, and she fed one. Then she went to feed the other one, and she was dead. She died of crib death. And I was just getting into this God thing at the time, and man, I was really crushed, you know. And I was really pissed off at God. I really, really got mad at God there, and I held that resentment for a long, long time. But I knew that I had to work through that, but I kept working on it. But Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon was there for us. They walked us through all that, you know. And that other twin is kind of like that girl that spoke last night. And she's incarcerated right now. She was a beautiful girl. I thought she was going to be a nun, you know. I really thought she was going to be a nun. And my son, we thought, he's going to grow up to be like a Joe Montana and go to Notre Dame and be this great kid. And we had all these plans for these kids, you know. And J.R. ran away with one of his actor friends when he was 16 and started following the Grateful Dead. And he met this girl while he was doing it too, and then they ended up in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and they went together for 3 or 4 years, and he still lives in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and he got married a couple of years ago, and he's doing great, you know. He went through the smoking pot a little bit thing on it, but he's not one of us, you know. My personal opinion is that I don't think you can drink yourself into being an alcoholic. I don't know, maybe you can, maybe it doesn't matter to me, but I know that I was an alcoholic from the get-go. But JR's doing great, and a couple of weeks ago, he had a baby, he had a little baby boy, and Betty Ann and my grandson went up there to see him a couple of weeks ago, and he's doing great. We talk to him all the time, but Amy, you know, Amy's Amy. And, you know, we've tried everything with her, but, you know, we just got to turn her loose, I guess. And my kids from my first marriage, I kind of let them go. Betty Ann had 3 kids when we got married. So she had 3, I had 3, then we had 3, you know, the Brady Bunch, I guess. And my son, who I bought the car for when he was 5 years old, started getting in trouble and started, you know, drinking, using. And he was doing the same thing I was doing, except he was going on further trips. He was going back and forth to Europe. And I think he was importing some kind of furniture. And I don't know what the hell was in the legs of that furniture, but he seemed to be making a lot of money, you know. And he was in and out of AA. And in fact, Keith sponsored him for a while. And one time he called me and he said, "Man, I'm all out of ideas. I'm really screwed up. I don't know what to do. You think Clancy'd let me come and live in the mission?" And I said, "I don't know. Call him." So I said, "Okay, you know, I will." So as soon as he hung up, of course, I called my sponsor, which is what I always do. And I told my sponsor about it, and he said, "I'll take care of it. Don't worry about it." And that's what my sponsor does for me. He takes care of it. He's done that for me for years and years and years. And any time I have a problem that I don't know what to do with, my sponsor takes care of it. And I'm grateful for that, and you know, and I'll never forget him, never, you know, be able to pay him back for that. And his wife does that for us too, Rebetty Ann. As a matter of fact, changing the subject a little bit, I don't recommend this to anybody, but it works for us. Betty Ann and I used to be very, very fight. We used to going to get a divorce every 3 days, and finally. Sally told Betty Ann, "Okay, if you're going to divorce him, you got to have it all set up. You got to have a place to go, you got to have the money, and you got to have a plan." So she didn't tell me any of this, but one night she said to me, "I'm leaving." And she called Sally, said, I got everything you told me to have, and I'm leaving." And Sally said, "Okay, before you go, come and have dinner with Keith and I." And so we went to dinner, and we talked about a lot of things, and one of the things Keith told me in front of her was, "You got to give 110%, 100% of the time, and expect nothing in return." And he told, and Sally told her the same thing. And then I made an agreement with her that I would let her turn me in. So if I get out of line, she can call Keith and tell on me. And you know, I don't know if anybody else is having problems in their marriage or anything, want to do that, but it worked for me, because I don't know about you, but the last person to realize that I'm being a jerk is me, you know. And so we'd get into these things, and she'd call me. And I remember, she hasn't done it for a long time. She hasn't had to for a long time, and I'm really grateful for that. But I remember when Keith would call me, I'd always know when Betty Ann had called him, but he'd always start the phone call the same way. "Robert, what's going on?" And I'd tell him about it, and he'd tell me what to do, and it put that kink in it, and we'd get through it, you know, until the next time, you know. And there was a lot of next times. But anyway, my son came down here, and he went in the mission for a while, and then he got into the group, and he was doing real well. He was sober a couple of years, and I helped him get into a little business, and I have a contractor's license. I let him use my license, and I got involved with it. But he had this wife back in Sacramento who was an alcoholic, who got drunk and wrecked the car and was doing all these crazy things. And she was calling him 30 times a day. And he said, "I got to go back to Sacramento and get this thing straightened out." And I told him, and I think everybody told him, you know, Robbie, don't do that. You know, let her get sober on her own. Let her sponsor and the people that she's working with get her sober. You can't help her. You need to stay out of that. And he said, well, I either got to go back and do something about her or I got to end it. And I said, well, I think you're making a mistake, but, you know, whatever you're going to do, you're going to do. Anyway, so he did that, and it was just before Christmas. In fact, it was on my wife's birthday, December 16th. He got in a big fight with her, and she threw the Christmas tree through the window or something. And he said, I'm going to go meet my sponsor and go to a meeting. And he left, and he went out the door, and I guess instead of going right, he went left. And I got the call about 3 in the morning that nobody ever wants to get from the coroner's office in Sacramento, that they found him dead in a dope dealer's trailer in South Sacramento. And he came, you know, I mean, just that one little mistake, you know, just that one little thing, and he's dead. And, you know, I couldn't believe it. So I called my sponsor, you know, and he said, you want me to, they just moved out here. And he said, you want me to come in, you know? And I said, no, you don't need to come now. He said, okay, we'll be in tomorrow. And they did. And they went to Sacramento with Betty Ann and I and helped us go through all the arrangements and everything. And it was a devastating thing. It really was, you know? And I was at my mother's house the day of the funeral, and Clancy called me and said, really, really help me out, because I didn't know what the hell I was, you know, how you're mixed up. And he said, listen, today's going to be the worst day of your life. But remember, it's just one day. So get through the day, take what you've learned in Alcoholics Anonymous, be an example to your ex-wife and your other children and your mother, and then when you get done with all that, come back and get back, go to your meetings, don't sit up front, don't make a big deal out of it, don't bring it up to people, you know, and just get back into your normal routine of life, and eventually it'll begin to be okay. And it began to be okay. You know, I mean, it's not okay. I mean, it never will be okay. I think about it all the time. You know, I don't think there's a day go by I don't think about it. You know, why didn't he just go right instead of left? Why, you know? But that's the way it is. And when the coroner, the autopsy report said he had a minute speck of amphetamines in his system. And I guess his heart had been so damaged from all the cocaine he did that it, one more time after being sober, killed him. So that's the way it is. That's what happens to people like us that don't do what we're supposed to do, you know. And about not too long after that, my daughter, Amy, she was sober for a while. And she met a guy in a group, and she was in our group, and she was doing kind of okay. And she met this guy, and they were going to get married, and of course they did it the way they do now. She got pregnant, then they're going to get married, you know. But we got a beautiful child out of it. But she got loaded right after they were going to get married, I guess, right after she started to get pregnant. And so he left her. He left her alone. And she came to live with us, and she had the baby, and then he lived with us. And then she got back doing what she does, and she's been in and out and back and forth. And Cole's been in and out and back and forth. And after a couple of years, his father kind of came back into the picture, because he wasn't in the picture at all, and he was sober. So Cole went to live with his father for a while, and Betty Ann and I were very involved in his life. We'd pick him up every weekend. We'd take him on vacations with us. He'd spend the summer with us, and everything was going great. And in fact, when I had my 25th party, my AA party, Ted had 5 years, so we had a 5-year party for him and a 25-year party for me, and he was doing good. But he started doing what people that get away from Alcoholics Anonymous do, I guess. You know, he started slacking off on meetings, started doing this, started having an attitude, started changing things. And last August, Coley was at our house, thank God, on a Sunday morning, and I got the call again. We just found Ted dead after 8 years of sobriety, you know. And, you know, again, that's what happens to us. That's what happens to people like us, you know. And so now we got another. Now our life has taken another direction. We have a kid to raise, which is okay, I guess, you know. Until my daughter hopefully cleans her act up and gets her head on straight. And but you know, life is good. I'll tell you, the last 15 years have been the toughest 15 years in my sobriety, financially and all that, because I had worked my way up into construction. But when I came to Los Angeles in 1980, at the end of 1980, I got the first job I'd ever had in my life. And what I mean by that is just a regular job where you work 40 hours and they give you a check. And there's no deal. You know, there's not if you do this, you get this, and if you do that, you get this. It was just a plain old job. And again, you know, this ain't it-ism set in because I thought, this is what I need. This is going to be different. I'm going to get a paycheck every week. We're going to get a house. And I'll bring my family out up from Texas, and everything will be great. And da 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 da. And after about 4 weeks of being an employee with a regular job, I said, Jesus, now I know why people hate work. I couldn't stand it, you know. And then I got Keith as a sponsor, and I used to bitch to him about it all the time, and he'd say, you know, you just go to work every day and simulate enthusiasm. You know, get there early. You know, get there early. Do your job. Don't tell people what to do, because that's my MO, you know. They're all doing it all wrong, you know, if they did this and this and this. Don't tell them what to do. Just do what you're supposed to do. And when they hand you that check, be grateful. And if you do that, there'll be a change. Something will happen for you. And of course, I didn't believe it. You know, I didn't believe it anything. You know, and something did happen. You know, and you know, I'll tell you, by having an active sponsor and being active in Alcoholics Anonymous, there's two things that I've learned and I really believe that are very, very important to me. And that is one. The first thing is that this head doesn't give this person good information. Never has, never will. You know, I haven't had a good thought in my life that's good for me. You know, if I run on my thoughts, man, all bets off. And the second thing is, more importantly, I think, and I don't know if you can find this anywhere except in AA or in Al-Anon, is that my life works better and I feel better about my life when I do things I don't want to do more than when I do things I do want to do. And I never knew that because I'm a self-centered, egotistical SOB. My motto in life's a hooray for me and screw you, you know. And when I learned that concept and I began to experience it, and now I do the things that I don't want to do on a regular basis. You know, I mean, my first thought is, if it's good for me, I ain't going to do it, you know. And then I do it, and my life works better, you know. But I got that job, and then I got another better job, and in a few years I ended up being the senior vice president and chief operating officer for one of the largest commercial contractors in Southern California. One of the oldest and largest in Southern California. And I used to hear people at podiums say, man, I love my job. I go to work every day and I wanted to puke, you know. Who the hell could love their job? You know? And I got to that point. I got to the point when I loved my job. I had the big office and I had the car and I had the expense account and I had the six-figure salary and I had respect. I had everything, you know, and I thought I'm set for life. But what happened, you know, nobody's set for life. You know, the only place you're set for life, in my opinion, is in your head. If you make your life being set and realize that you're going to have to take care of yourself, then you're set for life. Because a corporate raider took over our parent company with the help of Milken and Bolsky, and they raided it, including the retirement fund and everything, and they just raided the company. And it ended up finally just closing up. And, you know, there I am again. I'm left out in the cold, you know. And they all went to jail, but big deal. You know? Anyhow, I had to go on to the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. And the one regret I have over my life, I've made a lot of money in my life in various times. And the one regret I have is that I spent it faster than I made it. Because I'm almost 70 years old now. And through my good investments and money management, I got enough money to last me the rest of my life if I die tonight. And it shouldn't be that way, you know? It shouldn't be that way, but it is, you know? Anyway, but we have a good life. Betty and I have a fantastic life. We really do. We're active in the program. We have great sponsors. We have great friends. We have, see people around here, our friends. Great to see Kuinga again. I've seen her for years. You know, and I remember Kuinga, we always talk about this, when she was about 30 days sober, we all took a meeting to Bakersfield and took Kuinga with us. Boy, she was something else in her big moo-moo. But look at her now. I mean, you know, there are miracles in this program, and we have the opportunity to be part of those and to see them happen. And I'm going to close with a little line in the big book that is something that really is basically what I think that I try to do is, you know, and I know that if I don't do it, my life's going to have problems, and I've been guilty of not doing it. And it's a little line that says, there's one law and there's two not to do. And the law is love. And the second thing is that we can't interfere with the growth of another human being. And the next thing is that we can't interfere with our own growth. And I've had a real difficult time with that, especially with my daughter, not interfering with her growth. And when I do that, it interferes with my growth, you know. And it, you know, and we got to juggle that little thing. At least I do, to make sure that I practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in all of my affairs, especially with my family, and especially with the people like her that are trying to get this program. Because I don't want to chase her away from this, you know. I hope when she gets out in November that she's got an opportunity to get what we all have, and she has that opportunity, but she needs to be willing to go to any lengths, you know. I know when I got sober, when I had that experience when I was walking in the snow that day, I know now that up until that point, I hadn't conceded to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. I just thought I was a guy trying to have fun. But I did at that time, and since then my life has changed. And what happened is I got willing. I got willing to take direction. I got willing to do the things that I need to do to stay sober. And as a result of that, my life works good. And I hope yours does too, and thank you.